It was no dream, though it seemed a dream. It was not I, though it seemed I. And yet it was both and all, and still it counted. He said he wanted to see her, Ben. He said he fought to fay her. He came a one, he came a one, he came alone to see her. He said he was it tuned to be, he said he wasn't to be. You're listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void. Fingerprints of the Fallen Down, Part 2. Yes, I know, it's been 2 years, but this is a metaphysical murder mystery, and such things take time. Part 2. The Moxley Box. My cabin smells of silence, so I think, and as well of reading and quiet, non-cleaning up sorts of chores, and nowhere of laundry agents, of fragrant sprays or cinnamon buns, though I do love such things. Myself, I am not much of a washer-upper, neither sweeper nor a scrubber-bee. I am especially not an ironer, though I suppose I would be if a point other than flatness could be found. But the flattening wish is surely trumped by my other passion, which is not doing anything that doesn't need doing, which, as I have come to find, is mostly everything. I have a broom, though it mostly doesn't. I've had the same soap chip in the same bowl by the sink since the beginning of time. I've replaced the sink and kept the soap. It is a species of archaeology to prize it from the saucer, and even so, it has by now lost all its bubbles and only smears my hand with a kind of hamburger grease. I do splash out my tea-stained cups, and after supper I'll drop a string of water over my plate before setting it right back on the shelf, wet as a lake, as though my lamb chops never happened. If I stir my tea, I'll suck the spoon clean and set it back hot and refreshed in the drawer. If Ben Franklin stopped by and had the urge to report my condition in the form of a maxim. He might write, "Cleanliness of a kind is had by way of neatness of a sort. I keep my things hidden and well stowed, and this scarcity of things mostly does the trick as far as hygiene, so-called, as I define it, which I have found not so much a matter of scrubbing as of a lack of property. And then, of course, my old wood floor and my dead brown walls and every last cup and trinket that I manage are so time-worn that the insult of added dirt would be as like to drop feathers on a bird. So I don't much clean, beside putting away the things I use. I do read and cook and other things, walk about and sleep. Yet as against my argued state of near stillness, there is a small host of actions, the Redmond-Moxley actions, I call these, which I am loath, and yet herewith confess." I am an inveterate clone, a natural mimic. I thought that I'd put such reproductions behind me. But early this winter, one late morning in town, I realized that the fever to copy the small actions of others had come upon me once again. "Are you mocking me, Norman Foster?" a gravy slow voice called out. I knew at once that it was Redmond Moxley. Of course, my name is not Norman Foster, but that is the address Moxley uses for nearly everyone. And so I turned to watch the rising showdown between Mocker and Mocky. But there, Redmond Moxley stood, awful, arduous, really the most odious person in town. His brow was raised, the cheap low beams of his eyes drilling my way. "You're speaking to me, Redmond," I said. "Are you mocking me, Norman Foster?" he said again. Now he made a slight, sword-like swipe across the air with the stick he had, and quite unconsciously I saw myself following suit. I had in my hand a stick I didn't know I had, and against my own will slashed the air with it. Shocked by action and possession, I dropped my stick and shoved my hands into my pockets, for you see, Redmond Moxley is a stick man, well known for his pine switches, and I am not. He likes to tap his leg or swing it at weeds and uses it like language as he speaks. He rocks it coyly to and fro with pretty ladies and whacks his knee while talking to sturdier persons, as though he were a storybook character who lived in fields and spent his once upon a life pleasantly sucking weeds and singing to magic crickets. So, to my personal horror, through my long dormant blood fault, Moxley caught me, unconsciously aping him. And though I threw my stick down and vowed to never hold another again, I have lately become a part-time haver of this habit. I carry a stick and whack my leg, just like Moxley, and by God, I like it, and by God do I hate that I do. And by God do I hate that Redmond Moxley caught me in the mirror. Well, the council. Well, the council.
Thank you. sir.
Grinning Tom, the plowman's son, left the village on the run. All the gold found in his sack went to pay the miller back. Now the miller's debt is paid. Grinning Tom hangs in the shade. Pretty birds baked in the pies. Here it lives. There was a warning sign. I should have seen it. A few days before the stick incident, I was walking along in a daydream of sorts. Cold late afternoon. Kind of quiet burn going through town. The snow was soft, a threadbare wind, deserted eyes, dipping yellow sun. Amidst the quiet, there remained one still vital thing, however. A little girl out ahead of me, playing and galloping about. I followed in behind her and along the sidewalk we went, she in front, me in back. She became fascinated by her sun-kissed shadow and soon had raised her arms to turn her shadow into a plane. She banked her shadow plane left and right and then suddenly stopped, noticing the approach of a monstrous shadow jet. The one that I was making. She turned around, and there I was, a crumbly old man with both arms raised. She stared at me nearly enraged, increeped, and just a little curious. I bowed, apologized. I was wondering, I told her by way of explanation, whether my old propeller plane could fly as fast and well as your young and modern jet. She stared me down, that little girl. I should not be following damsels and forming squadrons, I ordered myself. Yet the inclination in my blood was there. It had returned from the long ago, a thing beyond my control, a freakish urge to copy. I folded my hands into my pockets and shrank all my actions except for the walking away from the scene of the mime. The hunger to imitate is perhaps why I went into the theatre, and why I was mildly suited to do so. And it was something that I forbid myself to do when I retired as a perversion to politeness. Copying the shadow plane of a little girl is one thing, but doing the stick business of the odious Redmond Moxley and being caught. I blush hard to think of it. I nearly vomit in the memory. I would never speak of such privacies, had not my weakness suddenly spread into every corner of Lemon, to the point where it was not just I, but all I knew who were forming themselves in Moxley's image. So I will tell you then of the big-faced, slow-poke Redmond Moxley, he of the Moxley boxes, a collector of money, who tried to hotwire this old farm tractor of a town and nearly turned us all. Or maybe, in fact, he did. Well, permit me to keep that bit as the bit that happens at the end. There are good people in Lemon, and bad, of course, as anywhere. And then there are those who are simply odious, whose all-consuming abrasion is somehow so generalized that there's not any one thing anyone could ever really point to and say, there is the main category of horror. For it is in the whole chafing craft of Moxley's being, the very system and fuel of himself, that secures my vexation. First, to be fair, he is a man of some peculiar charm, a man of booming voice and sudden umbrella smiles. He is that sort of over-clarified fellow in the coffee line, a head taller than anyone else, in knee-high English mud boots, shoved inside the skin of a dark turtleneck which rides beneath a painted sweater. He won't stand exactly in the line, no, but obnoxiously out of kilter with the rest of us, where he likes to call out the least pleasing penny jokes, one after the other, that out of force of politeness must receive the attention of our small smiles. "Did you fall down back there?" he might boom out to the barista, who momentarily disappeared behind the espresso machine. "Does anyone know if they have coffee here?" he will ask us, we who are so solemnly surrounded by Peruvian bean sacks and every manner of cafe gizmo known to man. And then, of course, when his turn at the coffee counter comes, he finds himself at last on the grand stage. Oh, what a spotlit stadium he makes of it! He banters endlessly with barn-broad smiles, and dithers about and taps that stick of his against his ankle while consulting the menu of muffins, and generally proceeds as though we all would spend good money to watch him decide his breakfast. If anyone is rankled or tries to hustle Moxley along, he will turn and examine them with gloomy intensity. "What do you suggest I do, Norman Foster?" he will say, which nomination, I should clarify, is Moxley's chief and only form of insult. The story of this, so we had it, was that there had been a real Norman Foster in Moxley's life, an enemy of Moxley, it would seem. And this real Norman Foster had crossed Moxley one too many times and came to a crisp end at Moxley's hands. So for a while I had my addiction to carrying a stick. I did it in private, in the woods and so on, and I'd drop my branch down as I came into town or at the first sign of life. That was bad enough, but other of Moxley's habits began to find credit in me. The first that I noticed. If you've seen a slow-motion film clip, you will note that even the most harmless action, a woman scratching her knee perhaps, can draw tears. Redmond Moxley has adopted this principle, I believe, to generate attachment and sympathy. For Redmond Moxley is an on-purpose, slowed-down person. He walks and moves and even blinks with the speed of a puddle. So, who now emulates this decelerated state? Who now reaches frame by frame for his coffee? Getting up click by clack from my chair, perfectly attending every jitter as I rise. And I freely admit there is great peace and pleasure in it, and but for the grim source, I would rejoice. Another one. Moxley lives alone, is unmarried, the sole survivor of his own nuisance, out beyond the train tracks on the way out of town. He has a small, tight house, sprung with all manner of antennas, and is in charge of some emergency ham radio network that I otherwise know nothing about. He's in the neighborhood of 60, I suppose, with his skin just starting to grieve. His silver newscaster hair is so bountiful a protection he never wears a hat. He carries gloves rather than wears them. So you needn't bother wondering who else has become hatless or which yours truly now carries gloves instead of wearing them. Which brings us directly and most importantly, to his boxes. Moxley is known for his brick-sized wooden boxes. For years, we've heard him cobbling them together in slow motion behind his antennas. The gunshot of hammers, the wood-eating saws. Most of these boxes he used himself for his own mystery, but he also sold them at the local artisans' cooperative. For years, I celebrated the dust that thickened over them on the cooperative shelves. Yet, my Moxley mania progressed until I found myself at that very store where, powerless to stop it, I purchased my own hateful box and, worse yet, was told it was the last one left on the shelf. Overnight, it seemed, his boxes had become a roaring madness. The cooperative manager, the blue-haired, black-eyed Dora Bees, said she didn't think she'd be able to keep them in stock. The reason for this sudden run? Moxley's use of the boxes had been divined. Marjorie Malander herself had teased out the solution. She had noted that Moxley was a daily visitor to the bank and had followed him from the bank one late morning as he carried his two bags of cash home, whereupon he almost instantly began to hammer a fresh box together. There was one hand and then the other. Marjorie rushed back to the cooperative with her idea and found that a Moxley box was a perfect fit for the storing of paper money. Much like my own bloody attraction to Moxley, there grew in town a terrible umbilicus to this habit. What began as a kind of nervous tension turned to incredulous wonder. Why was he storing money? This begat rousing anecdotes. He's burying his boxes and making treasure maps, which then petrified into unusual systems of belief. Moxley was taking out the maximum amount daily, it was said. He preferred $5 bills. He was soliciting money via ham radio, getting strangers to fill his coffers by means of some grand scheme. What scheme, we wondered. The hardware store began to stock ham radios, and antennas began to leap from the earth. There were those who claimed yesteryear recollections of Moxley when he first arrived in town at the age of 16, when it was said he was a hater of pennies, that he threw them in the snow or in the river or unceremoniously after a small purchase, would toss 2 or 3 cents in the trash while muttering Norman Foster's name. These stories frothed into a whispery whirlpool that ripped, as such things do, into a kind of wicked possibility. A thing to do, a novel experience to be had. Get yourself a box and fill it with your cash. The boxes flew off the cooperative shelves, and my fellow citizens could now be seen leaving the bank with cartoon bags full of savings. A full-on Moxley madness.
Upon a time was a bird who just stood on a branch of a tree in the flush of the wood. Never flew round as every bird should. It never went off, he just did what it done. One day I went over to have a small word. I climbed up the tree, Lucifer said, and became the next story you almost have heard, called the man who mistook an old stick for a bird. Once upon a tree was a man who was me. At least for a while I thought I was he, but he weren't where I was. It was us, it was we. I said I thought I was you, he said I thought you were me. We each shouted out, we like a small word. We broke off the stick we mistook for the bird, and became the next story you almost have heard, called the we of the tree broke the stick of the bird.
I don't desperately would prefer to say that I participated in this frenzy to expose the fraud, but I was the first fool at the fair, the first gumdrop on the ground, and my one true hope was that I would never be found out. Let them all run mad with their boxes, and if perchance informed of the local trend, I would offer my condolences and a little my contempt.
When the bow breaks, we shake into the seeming. When the dream wakes, abandon us to being. When the bow breaks, we shake into the seeming. When the dream wakes, abandon us to being.
As Moxley liked his fives, I had a preference, it seemed, for the starchless older fellows, the grubby silk singles that had been sanded and shoved by too many hands and pockets. I suppose I liked their library softness as against the ongoing agreement that they were still as valid as any brand new bill. And soon, inside my box, I had built a fine Civil War regiment of 14 or so old-timers. "Oh, I see," Marjorie Malander commented when she saw that I'd succumbed. I recoiled, blushed, even reached, in hateful slow motion, "Damn you, Moxley," for the box as though it weren't too late to hide it. A bird lover, Marjorie had sprung a visit on me one afternoon to fill my feeder and suddenly invited herself in for tea before I could even realize I had anything to hide. It is too much to add, but add it I will, that Marjorie mailed everything using bluebird stamps and wore bluebird pins and crocheted bluebirds and just would not for any moment not be loving them or wearing them or using them or trying to see them. At any rate, she ignored my flushing face and ponderous all-day reaching and began a rundown of the known accumulations and box types of others in town. Not everyone had an official Moxley box, she told me. More were being produced, of course, at Moxley's interminable rate of -7, her terminology, and Marjorie had put her name down on the cooperative list, with only 11 people ahead of her now. Marjorie had had to improvise, and by this time had over $34, comprised, she said, mostly of 20s, which she stored in an indoor birdhouse. Her other bird friend, Edith Avery, lover of orioles especially, but other orange birds were also nice, kept 7 $10 bills in a tissue box. She told of others. Different amounts, different boxes, one local bank, and there were only two, and one was barely there, had begun to sell unauthorized copies of Moxley boxes for the sole purpose of money collecting, while the less there one had begun a rigorous campaign to stop it, setting up placards and signs and windows around town that enforced the message that keeping money in boxes at home was nearly the most catastrophic thing a person could do. Their most compelling work presented the image of an old woman in a house dress leaping from a plane. "I keep my money in a wood box on the window sill," the caption reads, and the woman is, though smiling, on the verge of a rotten discovery. It takes a moment, but soon, you see, her poor banking methods have led her directly to leaving her parachute back on the plane. A conversation commenced on the fallout of all this money hoarding. Would our two banks, deprived of their iron, begin to fail? Would the boxing lead to a little apocalypse? Store closures, job losses, starvation? Were we all spending less? Or, as late philosophy suggested, did we each of us have this certain amount of perishable money, cash which for some unfigurable reason we could simply afford to box and never use? for reasons I associate with the thrall of celebrity, Moxley's bon mots at the coffee shop were now treated with beefy laughter, and it became common to see people wandering about town with pine switches, knocking them gamely against their legs. Even his habit of carrying gloves and not wearing a hat found minor success with his more hearty emulators. Worst of all, and perhaps it was madness on my part, but I felt quite sure that the entire small population of Lemon had gone slow. It was not something I could exactly prove, except to continually note a general molasses everywhere. People sat in their cars endlessly before getting out. The lone light would change from red to green, and the waiting cars would tremble in their vacuum until the cycle had nearly come round. You could not get a table at the cafe, as no one would ever depart, and the line, always slow, became a totem pole of cement. It was midway through this craze when I rather shook from the spell. One terrible winter afternoon, 3 or so months into the Moxley boxing, I stood on my cliffs with snow mantling the air. I was hitting my leg with a Moxley stick while muttering Norman Foster in slow motion, while pondering how much cash I could extract from the bank to feed my Moxley box habit. And then suddenly, a kind of hammer blow to my heart. Why? Not why I did it. Why did he? What had this devil, this Pied Piper, contrived to do to us? And what sort of cliff was he leading us to? I donned my hat and fitted on my gloves and shoved my Moxley box into my pocket and threw my stick into the four winds, and as quickly as I could, nearly running, I made my way into town toward the insidious antenna lifestyle of Mr. Redman Moxley and his hatlessly big face. I've been a soldier, a searching for a war, a social athlete, looking for a score. I've been a lion on a hunt for big game. I can smell the blood in the water now, honey. Ain't that a shame on my life? I'm subject to myth and law all my life. Turn water into whiskey, and I made the masses sick. Bear in the desert with the queen of old men. Trouble with tough vision, brothers. You might not come your way again all my life. Been the subject of myth and law all my life. I've been praying. Slumlord, while sleeping on the street, I've been the altar boy, and I've also been free. I scorch a pathway wherever I may roam. Okay, you sons of bitches, it's time to burn some bridges. Build a subject of myth and law. day, freshly falling snow. I came swiftly along the frosted train tracks, just in time to see Moxley creeping out his front door slow as a cabbage. I watched him reach into a tree and snap himself off a long companion. With two Moxley boxes, one under each arm, he set off across the snowfield. Above his roof I saw a line of smoke. Though it rose in my vantage from nearest chimney, in fact it came from a fire on a distant hill behind. As I went round to get a better look, I saw that Moxley had already become a small dot in the line scratch of the storm, so evidently he could move quickly if he desired. And strangely, Moxley was not alone. There were others, dozens of them, crossing the snow-blurred field from different points, converging toward the orange speck of fire on the hill. There was only this to do, and so I joined the pilgrimage. Through the plain of wind and rough snow, and up the small hill I went to put myself among them. At 40 yards, the heat of the blaze sent forth its invitation, and around it 20 or more townspeople stood, with more arriving every minute. And even at my distance I could see the terrible thing they were up to. I felt a numb shock, but what else could it be? Marjorie Malander, covering her face with an elbow from the heat, moved toward the fire and tossed her birdhouse in, and then, for some peculiar reason, lay down upon the snow. Moxley himself stood closest to the blaze, as though he alone could withstand it. His gloves and stick lay on the ground, and in each hand a single box. I joined in, a raindrop to the ocean, and watched the burning of the boxes, the burning of the money. Impossible, I thought. This is not at all what is happening. No one would do it. Money may be a foul necessity, but necessity it is. These people were not burning money. They were burning their own safety, their own futures. I would have thought the boxes empty, had they not, in the burning, disgorged their bellies, and I witnessed the green paper bills fuming black in the yellow fire. I went to him then, into the closet hell of heat, and stood beside him in the melting. He was weeping and smiling like the moon become the sun. Yet I could not speak. What question could there be? What argument might I have? I had wonder and peculiar rage, but also dreadful, dreadful curiosity. What foul dream by what foul demon was here before, within me? Something of a figure, aren't I, Norman Foster? He said to me. His voice was deeper now, and had lost its slowness. He was not proud, but sad, scornful, wide, wide open before the fire. And so, Moxley continued, I have always been. Well, for many years I kept it to myself by means of effort and queer strategy. By the age of 12 I was a foreman at the docks. A foreman, Norman Foster. Can you imagine? I had 12 men beneath me, some in their 7th decade. 12 years old and leading such a force of wharf rats. I have always had this magnetic way with people. It frightened me then, in so pleasing a way. And it frightens me now, in a way I can't describe. It was far too much for anyone, too strong, and so easy. I could bend the will of anyone to any end with the merest glance. And there was nothing I could not do, or have, or possess. He stopped for a moment, turned to face me now. But there was one dock worker immune to my charms. A loud fellow, much older than me, of course, but a magician with the crane. He made rude jokes. He was never not without a little stick. Impervious to the cold, he claimed, and so never wore a hat or gloves. most fascinating to me was his contempt for money. He used to tear half his pay up and throw spare coins off into the sea, which is how I got this idea. Moxley gestured at the fire, and we watched as an old married couple stepped forward and with some seemingly rehearsed ceremony conjointly tossed a wooden milk crate full of cash into the fire. The vastness and sluggishness and brute power of the crane matched him well, Moxley continued. He was slow, common, large, vulgar. He worked for me, but hated to do so, and dragged against my every order. And this was Norman Foster, a guest. And here Moxley smiled, and I felt his rare power steal into me. I was even then a perfect mirror of the man, myself drawn directly into smiling in exactly Redmond's manner. He dropped his smile, as much to show me how quickly he could drop my own. "Not exactly," he continued. "If, for example, I told him to join with the Stevedores to help unload a small ship, its cargo too small for his crane, he'd say in his slow, slow voice, 'But I'm no wharfie, I'm the cranesman,' and he wouldn't budge. I could not control him, and for the life of me I couldn't figure out why. Why was this lummox immune to my magic?" Moxley took a step close to the fire and tossed one of his boxes in. As I watched it burn, I felt the tug within, the tremendous urge to follow suit. I braced my own Moxley box hard against my pocket as to batten down my hatches. "This went on," Moxley continued, "and I grew a thundering, tiresome rage around it. I didn't want him fired. I wanted him to bend, to fall, obey. But he withstood. This ridiculous toad of a man refused my siren, was outside the circle of my power. And so, one afternoon, I was 14 perhaps, I ordered him not to go down to the end of the dock to check our utility list. And so, of course he did. And there he found my men waiting, the men I had sent. And they set about at once to beat him unconscious to the lesson of my authority. Paint the dock red with him, is what I said. As simple as that. And they did. They did not protest it. Do you understand? Around me, a man becomes an automatic extension of myself, my wishes. To myself, I called them auto-men. These are my auto-men, my soldiers, myself, me, my proxy, my flesh elsewhere. And at that age, and with the little awareness I had gained, I began to wonder how large my flock might grow, what treasures I might find in this self-expansion. I knew I wanted to be a very rich man. I wanted money, treasure, glory, power." He paused and held my eyes. "I wanted all, Sherwin. I wanted the whole place. Do you understand? There have been men and women like me in the past. Wielding this power brings a want as hard as iron. For why not? To be born with such command is to be the broker of its increasing manifestation. But here was this lone, absurd dissident, telling his joke and whacking his leg and spinning coins out into the sea. And so, and quite obvious it must be by now, I imagine, my auto men killed the dissident. They beat and stomped him and painted the dock red with him, such that when I went to see the body, there was little left of form. I leapt at once into the ocean, I wanted to douse my impact on the world, sever my connection. I vomited and beat myself and gouged my eyes as I sank to the bottom. I stood, finally, beside the doom-like pillars of the wharf, ice-cold and black. This shall be my grave, I thought. I longed to be chilled and numb beyond feeling or memory, and not just memory of the past, of the future that I saw unfold before me. I was not a wicked boy, but the wicked, wicked tool at my disposal made for wicked, wicked wants, and I saw that the journey I had begun had only one destination. If I continued in my own footsteps, the world at large would be lined with dissidents. I might be made a king with a crown and throne of gold, but beside me, an endless seaside of docks painted in the blood of my enemies. How many would I kill before I was done? He stopped and then put a hand to his neck in a choking manner, which action I quite naturally copied. I began to drown, and yet I stood. A choice arose, perhaps from the fear of obliviation. I could die right then, yes. Or was there a way to unlock myself from the heart of my power? I was what I was, and the charm flowed from my being without word or action. How might I not sing the unholy song of myself? Only one answer did I perceive as I drown. To become is like that which most resisted me. To become is like my dissident. His name was Redmond Moxley, as mine was Norman Foster. And if you wonder of my use of it, it is a warning to myself that my song is being heard, and that I must take steps to stop it. He lowered his hand, and I lowered mine, and we both turned to examine the fire. I rose from the water, shoveled Moxley's parts into the sea. I picked from the dock the long pine switch he carried, and as slow as he, I made my way off and into the world. And it is my opinion that a million lives or more were saved right there. Moxley stepped again toward the flame, and I followed him. It was all boxes, all burning money. The smoke that rose was a greenish-gray, and fragments of bills floated up burning as with the desire to be spent before they went to ash. I am lonely, sir, is what it is, Moxley said. Without and never having had a single friend, my sort of power exerts to blood or is held in place by enormous distance. I don't know where anyone is or how to get there from the place I put myself. And so I conceived a new idea. Could I be myself in a world where there was nothing to be gained? Could I be a king subtracted of any possibility of bloodshed? Yes, I thought, if only there were no treasure to be had, no crown, no throne, because no gold. Moxley stopped for a moment uncertainly. I think, Moxley continued, this will mean something beyond the smoke and snow. I think they will remember what they found, what they left behind. I think they will remember who it was that led them here. Rebirth is a thing of loss, an experience of strange emptiness. A terrible regret I have, a symptom of my old pride, is that the millions I allowed to live, by myself not living as I might, that they never got the chance to thank me. Moxley glanced a little at those who stood around us. My friends, he called. My friends. There were neither tears nor smiles of any sort, but a look of wonder and of grief, and a little of anger on the faces round the fire, as though they had just in this moment willfully tumbled in their cars over a cliff and down a chasm. What had just happened, and why had they done it, and was it a good thing, or a terrible thing? Had they survived, or were they dead? Remember me, my friends, as you now remember yourselves, Moxley shouted into the roar as he raised his final box. And closer to the heat he stepped until I could not see him for the flames. And even then he dragged me with him, and I pulled my box out from my pocket and tossed it hard into the brightening yellow, and then watched it burn until I felt the skin on my face begin to welter and my hair to singe. And I threw myself back down on the ground beside Marjorie Melander. Her cold hand took mine, and we watched the smoke rise into the snow as ropes and chains, until each became the other. A bleary sweetness came to my heart. I blinked and turned. No hill was this, but Paradox Mountain. Not Marjorie Melander, but the hand of Avis Hearn, cold and dead, with a bullet in her head. "Did you see?" a small voice spoke from the darkness. And then above me, I saw the wooden glasses and the wild hair of Helen Eleanor. "Did you see who did it?" she asked.
"I only know something is happening. Treasure that spills in boxes and bills that tires I made stand in the firelight. Boxes and bills and treasure that spills.
It was both and all, and still it counted.